everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
That was Dr. Hans Kochler. Kochler was a UN observer to the Lockerbie trial, in which a Libyan national, Abdelbaset El Megrahi, was convicted of the bombing of 270 aboard Pan Am Flight 103, which crashed in Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. Megrahi, who has been locked away since 2001, was just released on compassionate grounds by Scottish officials as he dies from terminal prostate cancer. We revisit the controversial trial and assess the highly politicized nature of the case and discuss the role of international institutions. Who controls them? Who are in charge? Are they democratic? Does the UN represent the people of the world or serve the interests of a few powerful countries? But first...
being released on compassionate leave is not contingent on giving up your appeal. He should have been able to continue his appeal and be released on compassionate leave. But Megrahi was basically blackmailed into giving up his appeal. Now, you know, why did that happen? The answer is probably, I think you must ask, who benefits? And the answer is British business interests, energy companies with major contracts in Libya.
That was freelance journalist Hugh Miles. Miles was once Journalist of the Year, according to Sky News, and has written extensively on the Lockerbie case. He, too, questions the legitimacy of the trials and explains the geopolitical interests that underlie the proceedings. I'm Justin, and you're tuned in to CHR 105.5 Radio Basics.
Been in contact with the Scottish government indicating that we objected to this, and we thought it was a mistake. We're now in contact with the Libyan government and want to make sure that if in fact this transfer has taken place, that he's not welcomed back in some way, but instead should be under house arrest. We've also obviously been in contact with the families, the Pan Am victims, and indicated to them that we don't think this was appropriate.
On August 20th, 2009, convicted killer Abdelbaset El-Megrahi was released from a Scottish prison on what was said to be compassionate grounds. The 57-year-old former Libyan intelligence officer, who was dying of terminal cancer, was convicted on 270 counts of murder for allegedly bombing Pan Am Flight 103, which crashed into Lockerbie, Scotland, on December 21st, 1988. Upon Megrahi's arrival back in Libya, he was greeted to cheers and jubilation by hundreds of supporters. The celebration angered U.S. and U.K. officials, as you just heard. Megrahi's trial was one that was beset with controversy and scandal. The UN observer to the trial, Hans Kochler, who we're featuring on the show tonight, denounced the entire proceedings as, quote, a spectacular miscarriage of justice. And he told Radio Basics that he would fail a student if she presented an argument like the judge's opinion in his university classroom. Scotland, the United States, and the UK indicted two Libyans, and threatened sanctions against the African country if they were not turned over. Gaddafi must have learned his lessons from the effects of the sanctions on Iraq that would come a few years later. The basis of their case against Megrahi was that he and co-accused Lamin Fima conspired on the island of Malta to plant a bomb on Pan Am Flight 103. This information was brought forward by a Maltese shopkeeper who the appellate court, Hans Kochler, and even the prosecution found to be an unreliable source. Kochler told Radio Basics the shopkeeper was later awarded millions of dollars from the FBI. The charges against FEMA were eventually dropped by the prosecution. The prosecution then changed their entire case halfway through the proceedings, and Megrahi was still found guilty, even though the star witness and the evidence were not credible. Kochler said that he denounced the rulings as arbitrary and irrational. And that is the basis of the case that we'll be investigating tonight. We'll be going back in time and discussing the controversial nature of this case. When we come back, we will play the entire interview of UN observer, UN-appointed observer Hans Kochler, Professor Hans Kochler, who also teaches at the University of Innsbruck in Austria on topics such as international relations and international institutions.
We're having a party. I hope you are hearty. Sing it to me, children. Rum-ba-ba-doo, bum-bum-bum-ba-doo. Yeah. Well, this is Tasha T on CHRY 105.5 FM. Check it on your mean man.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. You're back. We are going to play an interview now with Dr. Hans Kochler on the controversial case of recently released Abdelbaset El-Megrahi.
If we could go back in time then to 2001, what was your assessment of the verdict? And can you also explain maybe your capacity as observer?
I did attend as international observer. I was appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations through an official letter of nomination to the Security Council. And that decision was made by Kofi Annan on the basis of a Chapter 7 resolution of the Council, which had provided that international observers should be appointed at the trial as to ensure some transparency of the proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the official framework. My impression during the proceedings, which began in May 2000 and ended in January 2001, my impression was that those people who acted in the court, whether the prosecution team or even the defense team, and definitely most of the key witnesses, did not act in an honest manner. And finally, the judgment that was made by the by a panel of three Scottish judges, the judgment which they explained in the opinion of the court, did not meet basic criteria of consistency of an argument. It was contradictory. It made, frankly speaking, it made no sense for me. If I may just explain, the argument, the main argument of the indictment was to show how two Libyan intelligence agents had conspired together on the island of Malta to place a Samsonite suitcase containing a bomb with plastic explosives on a plane of Air Malta, and to place it there as an unaccompanied luggage with final destination New York, which would have required two transfers of the luggage, one from in Frankfurt, from the Air Malta plane to a Pan Am feeder flight, and the second one at London Heathrow. And during the trial, suddenly, in the course of the trial, suddenly, the prosecution did change the text of the indictment. That made me already suspicious, and they had announced that they would not anymore refer to the second Libyan suspect as a member of the Libyan intelligence services. And finally, the judges came up with a decision, with a verdict, according to which one suspect is guilty and the second suspect is not guilty. What I had expected in light of what I had seen was a not proven verdict for both, because not proven is the third possibility according to Scott's law.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, the judges, as I said, made this sacrificium intellectus, this intellectual sacrifice, and confronted us with something totally illogical. Because if first you say that, or if first you try to explain that two people conspired to carry out that crime, and then you say the second person had nothing to do with it, because the second person is not guilty, there is only one, so the entire argument collapses. But that is just the, so to speak, a logical evaluation, or an evaluation in terms of consistency. The other real big questions were related to the fact that everything, what the court had developed in terms of the argument, depended on circumstantial evidence. There was absolutely not one piece of evidence directly linking the supposed perpetrator of the crime to that crime, and the witnesses who were presented in court, particularly the key witnesses, those who provided the testimony that was vital for the judgment, those were totally unreliable. For instance, the shop owner from Malta, Mr. Tony Gauci, whose identification was absolutely essential to convict the one Libyan, the first Libyan suspect. This shop owner did contradict himself repeatedly. He had identified different people over a period of time as those who had bought clothes in his shop, and as we know by now, we did not know that during the first trial. As we know by now, he was invited by the Scottish police for holidays to Scotland for salmon fishing, and he later got $1 million reward from the American FBI after he had identified the Libyan Megrahi. So that is just one case. Another case, another key witness, was a Libyan-American double agent named Abdul Majid Jaka, who the Americans brought from the United States as a witness with, as I remember, a big number of special security around his, security guards around him. And this gentleman was earlier, in those days, when the crime was supposedly prepared in Malta, he was stationed in Malta, and he had stated that he saw the two Libyans carrying a brown Samsonite suitcase into the airport. Later, by the way, the court during the court proceedings, that statement was also counseled, was taken out from the argumentation. So now it could not be the basis anymore for the final decision of guilt, because this gentleman had even been proven totally unreliable in court, because confidential messages to the CIA, from the CIA station in Europe to the CIA in the United States, had revealed that the Americans himself mm-hmm. poached this gentleman and had no confidence in him. So even the judges dismissed that person's testimony. But it would have been, anyhow, the fact that he originally said that he saw the two Libyans carrying that luggage, that fact could not even be used in the opinion of the court by the three judges. And there were many other things like that, also concerning a piece of forensic evidence, a fragment of a timer that was supposedly found on the crash site. As we know now, that fragment may never have been on the crash site, and it may have been inserted later.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite delicate and quite long story, and it all might have come out now if the second appeal would have gone ahead in Scotland, which will not be the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can talk about the appeal process. What happened with the first appeal, and how does the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission come into play?
Yeah, as far as the first appeal is concerned, I remember it well. It started without a too long delay. This is noteworthy because it took so many years now until a second appeal was ordered, but the first appeal just started several months after the verdict had been issued. It began in fall 2001 and ended, as I recall, in March 2002. The appeal court consisted of, there was a panel of five Scottish judges, and interestingly, and I remember that vividly, one of those five judges, Lord Osborne, he did challenge the so-called Malta theory. I remember he said in open court that for him it does not make sense in any way to believe that it would have been possible to cause the explosion of the Pan Am jet after it had taken off from London through this way, by hoping that the timer device, which is not a barometric device, a timer device could be transported as unaccompanied luggage, taking all those risks, namely that no plane should be delayed, and nothing can go wrong at these big airports in Frankfurt and Heathrow as far as luggage transfer is concerned, and so on. So after I had heard that judges ridiculing the official opinion of the trial court, I thought he would definitely vote in favor of the cancellation of the verdict. But strangely, this second decision, which confirmed the first verdict, was again unanimous, as the first one was. So there were five judges, and in spite of the clear critical position of at least one of those judges, finally he went ahead and again and he endorsed the upholding of the decision. After that was in March 2002, and after that the convicted Libyan did make a step that was ill-advised, as far as I can see, because he got the wrong advice from his legal team. He did proceed to the European Court of Human Rights. That is a possible avenue if someone feels that his basic rights to a fair trial have been violated. But one can only pursue that avenue according to European law. After all, avenues within the domestic jurisdiction have been exhausted, but that was not the case. So later they were told that they will have to first seek a review process according to Scots law within the system of the United Kingdom. So they did apply, as far as I recall, I think in 2003 for a review of that judgment. So the case was presented in 2003 through the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission. And interestingly, albeit after a very long time, namely after almost 4 years, this commission has stated almost the same what I said in 2001 and then again in 2002, namely that I suspect a miscarriage of justice, and with this, by the way, also with almost the same arguments which I had carried at that time in my reports, namely in regards to the unreliability of the testimony of the Maltese shop owner, and also in regard to forensic evidence, and in regards to the influencing of witnesses, and particularly also in regard to the withholding of evidence, because that was another major issue for the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission, that substantial evidence had been withheld from the defense during the trial, but also during the first appeal.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on just what exactly was omitted?
What?
The evidence that was omitted.
What was omitted? One basic issue, the most controversial one, is information that originates supposedly, that was the speculation also during the trial, but it was all, even I remember it was communicated to the court by the prosecution, information that originated supposedly from a foreign government, and that is related to the timer device. That has been oppressed, and the reason at that time was that foreign policy consideration, or the foreign government is not prepared to provide this information. At the later phase, namely in last year, after the decision of the review commission had been made, it became known that there is other information about how the issue of this timer fragment had been handled by the prosecution, by the prosecutor's office, and that information also had been withheld. And in that regard, the British government, through the Foreign Secretary in London, Mr. David Miliband, issued a so-called public interest immunity certificate, which means that the government of the United Kingdom claims that there is a special national interest and security interest of the United Kingdom, and that the government of the United Kingdom does not allow the prosecution to disclose some of these documents, which, interestingly, those documents have been, since the beginning, in the possession of the prosecution. And this could have been challenged, this decision by the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom could have been challenged by the court. The appeal judges could have ordered the release, but they did not. They accepted a kind of compromise according to which a security vetted advocate, a security vetted defense counsel, specially chosen by the authorities, would be appointed, who could see a redacted version of these documents, but who would not be allowed to disclose even the redacted version to Mr. McGrahy's defense team. It is obvious that under such circumstances, normal proceedings would not have been possible in any way. And by the way, there are precedents what would have to be done in such a situation. The International Criminal Court, in a similar situation where the United Nations had refused to disclose information to the defense in regard to war crimes, the International Criminal Court had decided that they cannot continue the proceedings and that the prisoner has to be released.
Mm-hmm. And it's
no proper proceedings. If documents are available only to one side, there is no equality of arms in an adversarial system. If the prosecution has certain documents and the defense does not get those, and then the foreign minister interferes and states it's in the national interest not to share this with the defense, you can have no trial anyway under such circumstances. But all of this now is not playing out anymore, because the proceedings have been aborted in a very strange and very totally unacceptable way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spoke with one journalist who said that even though he was released, that's no grounds to forego with the appeal process.
Yeah, I have explained this and have written also in that regard to the Scottish Justice Secretary. And I have explained it much earlier when there was talk about the so-called prisoner transfer agreement and sending Mr. McGrahy back on the basis of a prisoner transfer agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom. that would have been problematic in legal terms, and that would not have been possible if the appeal would have continued. That is crystal clear. But compassionate release, which the Scottish Justice Secretary has granted now, has absolutely nothing to do with the question of guilt or innocence of a person, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the question whether there are ongoing proceedings or not. So there was absolutely no requirement on the part of Mr. McGarry to drop his appeal. But anyhow, he did it, and the sequence of events makes me suspicious, because he had received the visits of the Justice Secretary of Scotland, a few days later a visit of a Libyan delegation of six gentlemen, and one or two days later again he had signed a document or had authorized the dropping of his appeal, and a few days after this, after the 12th, he actually got released. So he had resisted for a very long time to give authorization for the dropping of the appeal, because he would have had to do that already in April, after Libya had applied for prisoner transfer. He would have been required to drop his appeal. He did not. He resisted. But now he was so desperate that he saw no other way. Apparently he had the impression that this would improve his chances to be granted compassionate release. Although legally there must be no connection. If there is, should that have been conditioned in any way, should that have been conveyed to Mr. McGarry that he would be expected to drop the appeal in order to be granted compassionate release, that would be totally illegal and also in violation of basic human rights and in violation of his personal freedom, because it would be a kind of a blackmail.
Definitely. Professor, maybe we could talk a bit more about international institutions. I believe you wrote once that there can be no rule of law with power politics in play. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, the simple reason is that the rule of law requires the separation of powers. That means, as far as the judiciary is concerned, and in our case criminal law is concerned, the judicial officers must act in total independence from the executive as well as the legislative power. And that is the case first and foremost for the judges of a court. And in those countries that have a well-established constitutional system, established over hundreds of years, at the domestic level, it may work one way or the other, not satisfactorily, because in many countries, as you know, the Minister of Justice has the authority to give instructions to the state prosecutor. But anyhow, there are some modalities according to which one can say there is a decent separation of powers. If it does not exist, everyone would say this is an authoritarian system and the country is headed towards dictatorship. The problem is in the international level. In the international level, there is no system of a separation of powers. Take the United Nations Organization. We have the General Assembly, but This is an assembly of all the member states, but it has no competence. It cannot pass international regulations, it cannot adopt norms. That function is reserved more or less exclusively to a much smaller body, the Security Council, where five states have a veto right. That means the national interests and security interests of those five permanent members with veto right essentially determine what the Security Council orders in terms of, for instance, enforcement measures and what it does not order. And in regard to the Lockerbie case, I mean, that is a very topical case. As far as Lockerbie is concerned, the Security Council had more or less bought the theory that two Libyan agents are the prime suspects and had ordered their surrender and had ordered Libya to comply with these demands and had imposed, as the world public public found out or could witness over a period of almost 10 years, had ordered punitive sanctions against Libya, total air embargo, plus also embargo in regard to technical items for the oil industry and so on. So that was the framework in which the entire judicial proceedings were set up. And in order to fulfill this demand for a trial of two Libyan suspects in a Scottish court, special arrangements were made, and one did change the Scottish rules even, because according to the Scottish rules, a jury should decide on in a criminal trial, not a panel of judges. And I personally guess that a jury might have paid less attention to considerations of United Kingdom foreign policy and so on than these establishment figures, these law lords, have done. And the problem in connection with the Lockerbie case was that there were very specific interests of the United States and the United Kingdom conveyed also through the mass media, particularly in the United States, very specific expectations that the court has to come up, has to bring at least one guilty person. And I think that's what they finally did, and they did it in a way that was totally unconvincing, because they declared one as the guilty man, and they returned the other one as an innocent person, as if it was a kind of political settlement between Libya and the other countries, a kind of compromise, 50% for one side, 50% for the other side. But that is, it makes only sense, this judgment, by the way, original judgment makes only sense politically, in terms of a political arrangement. And I do remember a top Arab diplomat was listening with me to the reading of the verdict in January 2001, and his immediate reaction within seconds after we had heard the judgment was, that has been negotiated. I cannot disclose the name of the country and the position of that person, but I just can say that.
Definitely. So, Professor, then what...
Insiders from the Arab world knew that... did evaluate it from the very beginning on that basis. They needed a scapegoat, and the Scottish judges were too afraid to come up with the decent and fair decision, which would have been not proven. That is what I expected after what we had been shown.
Mm-hmm.
Not proven in the case of both.
Mm-hmm.
So many uncertainties, ambiguities, so much was just based on hearsay and so on.
Mm-hmm, which led you to say that the verdict was arbitrary and irrational.
Yes, of course, and I also told myself if a student would have presented such an argument in the way these judges had drafted their opinion of the court, I would have, this student would have failed. I would not have accepted that. Would not have accepted that paper.
Mm-hmm. Professor, unfortunately, my calling card has only a few minutes left. So what is your assessment then of our international institutions, and what would need to be done to make the United Nations truly a people's institution?
As far as I can see it, the first step that would have to be made, which unfortunately is also the most difficult one, the first step would be to get away from this system of power sharing between the great powers of 1945, because the United Nations Charter in its present form incorporates the power balance of 1945, and that's why we have those five countries as permanent members with a veto right. This veto privilege given to these five individual countries makes democratic decisions totally impossible. And so that would be the first measure. The problem is that this would require an amendment of the Charter of the United Nations, and any amendment also requires the consent of these five permanent members, so it is also subject to a veto. And that is why I'm afraid that not another development that would be necessary is that there would have to be a redistribution of competences within the UN system and the General Assembly of the United Nations as that body where all member states are represented should also have or should also be given decision-making powers. Those should not exclusively be in the hands of the Security Council. And one third very important development would have to be that the International Court of Justice, which is officially part of the United Nations system, that the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is not the same entity as the International Criminal Court, something totally different. The Criminal Court does not belong to the United Nations, but the International Court of Justice should be more than just a body of arbitration of disputes between member states, provided that those member states freely subject themselves to the authority of the court. This court should be, as in domestic jurisdictions, as within municipal law, this court should be a kind of constitutional court of the United Nations, and it should be regulated in such a way that the International Court of Justice could also evaluate decisions of the United Nations Security Council in regard to their legality. Mm-hmm. Now, the prevalent view is that Security Council decisions cannot be subjected to any review by any other body. That means effectively the Security Council is above the law. And if you have such a structure where one institution is effectively above the law, you can never have democratic situation domestically. That would be the case if the head of state or the prime minister would be in such a strong position that the laws would not apply to him, and his authority would be above even the Supreme Court. If we would have such a situation, everyone would say that this is not a democracy, this is an authoritarian system. But that is exactly the situation which we have in the United Nations organization. But as I said, unless those five veto powers agree to a reform, nothing can happen. And nothing will happen because it's a kind of self-defeating mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Because reform requires the consent of the veto powers. So it's a kind of vicious circle. And I tend to believe that in not in the immediate future, but within several decades, there may be a development which will lead to the establishment of a new international organization, and which will be based on a new consensus. That means a new beginning will have to be made outside the framework of the United Nations organization.
Mm-hmm, right, and I think we'll leave it at that and end off on that for our listeners to ponder over. Professor, finally, is there any works of yours being made right now, or is there any place where our listeners can access some of your work?
Sure, I can. I think the easiest is that I send you the link to my academic website.
Mm-hmm.
There are works, two come to my mind, which may be of interest. One is that book, Global Justice or Global Revenge,
right,
which is now even one can access through Amazon in a digital version.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a book that is coming out just within 1 or 2 weeks, I guess, in India, in English, about world order, vision and reality, which explains all these, also what I said now.
Mm-hmm.
But should I send you links to those publications?
Yeah, absolutely. I can post them.
You can see and you can decide in what way you use this information.
Yeah, perfect. I can post it with the show at the very end.
Fine. And let me just be sure. Your name is
Justin Panos, P-A-N-O-S.
So I have your name on the email, yeah. I just wanted to be sure that it is you who I spoke to now.
Yep.
That it was not somebody else who was authorized.
No, it's me.
So it is you.
Yes.
And you are with York University?
Yeah, that's right. I study international politics at York University.
I heard about your university, and I think I met over the time scholars from your place and
It's conferences. It's growing to one of Canada's largest rivaling University of Toronto. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Professor, thanks again for
you're welcome.
Elucidating everything on this case.
You were just listening to Dr. Hans Kochler. Kochler was the UN observer to the Al-Megrahi trial, in which he wrote a report condemning the trial. And to have a professor such as Kochler, who's thought long and hard about international institutions. And, the role of the UN in society. And to denounce it as authoritarian truly means something from somebody that, knows these institutions throughout his career. And if you just simply go to his website and see the books that he's written, one is from 2003, Global Justice, Global Revenge. And more recently, he has one on world order, Vision and Reality, that's due out in, a week or two. And, he outlines pretty strongly what he was just reiterating there, in more drawn-out empirical form. So I suggest you check those out. Or if you go to www.radioforall.net, search Radio Basics, I'll post the links there. So we're going to go to commercial, and when we come back, we're going to play the second interview with freelance journalist Hugh Miles on CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM, on the World Wide Web at chry.fm, and on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
You're listening to Radio Basics. We're back on CHRY 105.5. We're going to continue on our coverage of the release of Al-Megrahi and the controversy surrounding his trial and his release. And this is the second interview with freelance journalist Hugh Miles, who's written extensively on this case. I began by asking Miles what was the response after the bombing by the United States and by Britain?
Shortly after the Lockerbie bombing, all the intelligence services around the world, plus the Dumfries and Galloway police, plus politicians and diplomats, all came to the conclusion that the gang responsible were the PFLP-GC, which is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, which is a rejectionist Palestinian organization headed by a man called Ahmed Jibril. Who is based in Damascus. And the general consensus is that this was the gang responsible, and Dumfries and Galloway police went so far as to name them and to name some of their members. And then in the run-up to the first Gulf War, suddenly the spotlight switched from this gang to the Libyans as new evidence suddenly came to light.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that led to the Libyan part of the story, which obviously is taken us to where we are today.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and, it seemed that Megrahi and another person became suspects. And that the question that I have is why did Libya hand over Megrahi, especially when, U.S. officials didn't think that would happen?
Well, it came after many years of trying by Nelson Mandela, above all. He spent a lot of time with Gaddafi trying to encourage him to hand over these two guys, who, of course, the Libyans have always maintained are totally innocent. Gaddafi was looking to come in from the cold. I mean, the handing over of Megrahi has to be seen in the context of a detente by the Libyans, which started in the mid-1980s and involved other things like giving up their nuclear arsenal. And this was to do with Libya's strategic realignment at the end of the Cold War. States and the Soviet Union would back it up, and that's what happened in the 1980s. But obviously at the end of the Cold War, Libya knew that it had to it had to appease America. And so handing over Megrahi was part of this process. And the Libyans, of course, thought that he would be acquitted. They thought he would get justice, and they assumed that both men would come home soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully we can talk about the case in a bit. You wrote in one of your articles that there was, or you claimed that there was no material evidence was presented linking him to the bombing. Could you just elaborate on that?
Right, well, I mean, there's no evidence that's ever come to light showing that Megrahi ever put the bomb on the plane, or that he even handled explosives. Megrahi is very tenuously linked to this crime. I mean, the principal evidence against him is that he was identified by this Maltese shopkeeper called Tony Gauci. But Tony Gauci this evidence is not valid because Tony Gauci had seen media reports about Megrahi prior to the identification, and Tony Gauci also identified another man called Abu Tal, who is generally believed to be, I believe is more likely to be the real Lockerbie bomber.
Mm-hmm. So it was just based on what this shopkeeper said that was sort of the biggest piece of evidence that was against Megrahi.
That's right. And this shopkeeper was highly unreliable and had been subject to enormous pressure and there's a lot of doubt about his evidence. And even the Scottish judges responsible for the guilty verdict have subsequently cast doubt on Gauci's testimony, and he was their key witness.
Mm-hmm. And what about the acquittal of the co-accused in this case, the person that actually was said to have planted the bomb?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to understand how the judges came to the conclusion that they did of finding Megrahi guilty and the other guy innocent. I mean, it just doesn't really make sense, and anyone who has looked closely at the case will, I think, not be convinced that Megrahi was guilty beyond reasonable doubt. And indeed, there's really no explanation why, if Megrahi is found guilty, his co-accused is not guilty. But, I mean, the fact is, Libya had nothing to do with it, I believe. And say, the Megrahi guilty verdict was the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. And also, Gaddafi paid, I think, $10 million to each of the victims' family. Is that true?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, if Libya then wasn't... why did they agree to pay out that much money?
I think because Gaddafi wanted to come in from the cold, and he saw that this was the price he had to pay for peace and to be left alone by the international community to be accepted. And he said, if this is what I've got to pay it. But
right.
The Libyans have always been clear in their position that although they were prepared to accept the ruling of the Scottish court, they never accepted that Megrahi was guilty. Mm-hmm. And they took responsibility without taking blame. And this distinction has been made several times by the Libyans.
I see. Okay, let's talk about the review and the appeals. In 2007, the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission, SCCRC, granted Megrahi a second appeal in June 2007. Why was that?
Well, it was because a great deal of evidence had come to light showing that a miscarriage of justice had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
The SCCRC referred the case because they thought that a miscarriage of justice was possible. So that's why they referred it.
Mm-hmm. And the question that I have now is, did Scotland release Megrahi to save themselves the embarrassment of wrongfully convicting him if, say, this second appeal process found that to be so?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think a deal happened. I mean, although it's denied, it seems to me there's no question that a deal was fitted up. And the deal basically was that Megrahi would drop his appeal, and in exchange he would be released on compassionate leave. When Megrahi left the UK, he made a speech, and in his speech he said, "I was given a choice, and that choice was either to die a condemned man, either to leave Libya and die a condemned man amongst his family, or else to stay and fight in Scotland and try and clear his name." Now, he should not have been given that choice because compassionate leave, being released on compassionate leave, is not contingent on giving up your appeal. He should have been able to continue his appeal and be released on compassionate leave. blackmailed into giving up his appeal. Now, you know, why did that happen? The answer is probably, I think you must ask, well, you don't know, who benefits? And the answer is British business interests, energy companies with major contracts in Libya, who risked having a problem if Lagahi had died in jail in the UK, because the Libyans had threatened a complete breakdown of relations. And, you know, British companies have major interests in Libya. And, of course, the other people who benefit are the governments. Both the British and the Scottish governments have a strong interest in keeping Megrahi as a convicted mass murderer. Because if he is acquitted, then, you know, this would raise a lot of questions about, you know, who did it. And doors would be opened, which would lead to a lot of embarrassment for the British and Scottish governments. So they both have a lot of dirty laundry.
Yeah, just in the London Financial Times today, you had David Miliband saying that what you just said, that there's business interests underneath all this. He said that is flatly untrue and almost disgusting that people would say that. And at the same time, you have Megrahi saying that he has evidence completely exonerating him.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Megrahi would say that. This is what people say when they leave jail.
Yeah.
I should think that he has got some pretty interesting evidence, and it probably it would exonerate him. Possibly, it would even show who really did it. But, you know, all this hopefully will be revealed soon when Tony Kelly, his solicitor, gets the green light to make the dossier of evidence, which has been kept secret up till now, public.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And, the Tripoli Post, on the day of his release, made the accusation that his condition, his prostate cancer, was aggravated in jail due to lack of care and treatment. And, you know, possibly if he had got proper care, he might not be on his deathbed today.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I think that, from what I understand, you know, this is just an act of God, and that he is very sick, and that he will die soon, probably, you know, within 3 months, as expected. So, you know, we just have to take it on trust, really, his illness is genuine.
Right. And, you made an interesting point before about, Libya's place in the world today in terms of resources and oil wealth. It wasn't too long ago that Gaddafi was in Italy wearing a picture of, the national hero of Libya being tortured and handcuffed by Italian forces, occupying forces back in the 30s. And, it seems that today Gaddafi has a lot of pull. So what you're saying about the business interests might just be true.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that Gaddafi himself is not actually interested in business. He's interested in politics. You know, he doesn't actually care for oil or money. He cares for power, and he cares about Libya's strategic place in the world ahead of this or that contract with an oil company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for him, it's all about being secure from the unipolar world where you've got to stay in with the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I guess finally, then, what in your estimation is the state of international institutions such as the UN and international courts when it just seems like power politics sort of rules everything?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this case necessarily reflects on the UN. I mean, I think the Lockerbie case is a very sad story, but the truth is we don't know the full extent of it. We don't know who's responsible for Lockerbie or indeed for the subsequent miscarriage of justice.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's hard to draw conclusions or blame people, I think, at this stage. But, I mean, certainly there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I think that ultimately, British and American authorities of the day and during the subsequent investigation, have got a lot to answer for.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Hugh, I think, I think that's elaborate on?
Well, just to say that we shouldn't forget that all this business about Megrahi being released and, whether or not the Libyans should or should not have a party when he gets home. I mean, all this is a sideshow. It's a sideshow of a sideshow. It does not address the fundamental question of, who blew up Flight 103, who fixed the trial, why, and these are the questions we need to keep in focus. And let's not
Okay. Hugh, is there any works of yours in being made right now, or anything you're working on that you'd like to talk about? And where can people find some of your work?
I'm a freelance journalist, and I'm the author of two books, one about Al Jazeera and the other one called Playing Cards in Cairo.
Mm-hmm. And you have a website?
Yes, I do. www.humiles.com.
Okay. Okay. Great.
That was, the second interview on the Al Megrahi case, and that was freelance journalist out of the UK, Hugh Miles, who has written numerous articles on this and, published two books. His website is www.hughmiles.com, and that wraps up our show for tonight. We looked at, the controversial nature of the Al Megrahi case and, his release, and... I think both our interviews kind of spelled out, what interest lied behind his release and just the nature of the controversial case. So, thanks again for listening, and CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
On me, let it shine on me. Let your light from the lighthouse shine on me. Let it shine on me. Let it shine on me. Let your light from the lighthouse shine.
Let your light shine on.